Good morning. So Paul writes in his letter to the churches in Philippi, "Brothers and sisters, join in imitating me and keep your eyes on those who walk according to the example you have in us." Imitate me, Paul says, and goes on, "Watch those who live like we do." Who is this us that Paul is talking about? Well, one of Paul's dearest friends, someone he constantly refers to as a son, Timothy, and someone else who the Philippians know and love, Epaphroditus. See, Paul is in prison for Jesus because he puts the gospel before anything else. Timothy is genuinely concerned for others, while everyone else, according to Paul, looks out for their own interests. And Epaphroditus nearly died serving Jesus and Paul. Paul isn't even a little bit shy about it. He holds himself up. He holds Timothy up, and he holds Epaphroditus up as examples to watch, as models to imitate. He understands that putting Jesus's teaching into practice, living Jesus's teaching, is not easy. It's not natural, it's not intuitive. And so followers of Jesus need living, breathing, flesh and blood examples to copy, which is why Paul offers himself and his ministry partners, "Keep your eyes on anyone who lives like us," he says. And this should sound so strange to us, right? I mean, we live in such a different time. We just had another famous Christian with a huge name and massive following and a ministry that makes millions of dollars a year turn out to be just a bunch of words. And we live in a culture that often says that words are enough. We've heard enough of our parents and pastors say things like, "Do what I say, not what I do." If their words tickle our ears, if their words ring as true, if their words inspire, if their words are good, then we're good. When a famous Christian falls from their pedestal, there is always the same kind of debate. Are their words true? Even if they were inconsistent from their life, can we still learn from them? There's a part of me that always wonders, maybe we can keep learning from them. But why? Why settle for someone who can talk about the truth when you can find someone who knows how to live it? If you wanted to learn a new skill or pick up a hobby, would you be satisfied learning from someone with no actual experience? Like, would you pay big money to someone for piano lessons who can't actually play the piano? Would you be satisfied if all they had if they had read some books and they sort of knew how to teach someone how to play piano? They understood the theory, but they had never played or couldn't play. Or would you rather have somebody who's read all the books and has been in the actual arena? Someone with deep head knowledge and practical experience. That's who Paul is. In Philippians 4, verse 9, he summarizes his advice to the Philippian churches like this: "What you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things," right? Like, not just what you've heard, but what you have seen in my life. More so, like, these aren't just ideas to get into your head, but these are things to be done. Actions to get into your body if you are going to follow Jesus. I mean, you'll notice this in every one of Paul's letters. Even in his letter to the Romans, which is considered one of Paul's densest, most heady of theological reflections. Isn't about having the right answers about God. That's not what Romans is at all, right? It's not like we're going to die and be faced with a pop quiz to prove that we can answer every question right. See, Paul is writing to churches all over the world because he is obsessed with helping the church to live well in this world, to live together as a single unified family, and to live as citizens of a different kingdom, to be the body of Christ, the flesh and blood of Jesus in the world and for the world. This is what Paul is obsessed with. And if we are ever going to have any chance of living like Jesus in this world, then Paul understands we have to know Jesus. And so Paul's letters do two things. They teach the church how to obsess over Jesus just as Paul does, because we cannot live like Jesus without knowing him. And these letters are drenched with him, right? Squeeze them and every drop contains Jesus. But this isn't so that we can know about Jesus. You can know about Jesus and never live like him. But this is so that, filled with the very spirit of Jesus, with our lives rooted in him, we might be the body of Jesus in this world. Does this sound like an incredibly high calling? It is. And Paul understands how high it is. But it's fascinating, right? You never get the sense that Paul is proud or arrogant about it. Like, while he's busy saying, imitate me, you don't actually hear him saying, hey, look at me, right? In another letter, Paul writes, be imitators of me as I am of Christ. And here to the Philippians, you get the same sense. Paul wants the Philippians to pattern their lives after him only to the degree that his life aligns with Jesus. And Paul, in this letter, makes it clear who Jesus is. See, being in the form of God, he did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but he emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in human likeness. And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. This is who Jesus is. We considered this last week. And we know Jesus as we participate with him in his suffering, as we are conformed to his death. In other words, the life of a Jesus follower is patterned and shaped by the cross. And the same for the church, right? This beautiful family of brothers and sisters adopted by God into his family. Our life together is patterned by, it's shaped by the cross. Jesus refused to grasp for power and position that was rightfully his. Instead, he emptied himself. He gave away his privilege and his power. He became a servant, washing the dirty feet of sinners. He became like those who he served, making it impossible to distinguish him from those he hung out with. And so he was accused of being a sinner along with them. He humbled himself. He obeyed his Father wherever it led him. And he suffered humiliation and rejection and shame and injustice, all for love, for us and for the world. Paul wants us to have the same mind that was in Jesus. He wants us to follow the pattern of Jesus' life into death and into resurrection. But he already understands how hard it is for people who have never met Jesus, like the Philippians, to really figure out how to live this pattern in new places and at new times. And so Paul lives it for them, in front of them. And so to Timothy and Epaphroditus, and Paul says, look here and look there. This is what it looks like. And yet still, it can be so hard, right, to know where to start. When you look at Mother Teresa, somebody who's more contemporary for us, right, it can be nearly impossible, it can feel impossible to know how to imitate her. If we're not careful, we can focus too closely on the wrong details in her life. We can hear a story about her feet, misshapen after years of wearing shoes that were too small for her. Or we can see her work among the extreme poor, those who were dying of their poverty in India, and pull the wrong details from those stories. Now this might sound silly, but I've heard stories of people who were so impressed by Mother Teresa's suffering that they imitated her by wearing shoes that were too small, so that they could suffer like her, hoping to become like her and become like Jesus. Or I've heard stories of people inspired by Mother Teresa's love for the poor, who then thought that they needed to travel to India so that they could work in the same exact communities as her. But both of these responses, they miss the point that we are called to live according to the pattern of Jesus where we are at, and in particular ways to our lives and our communities and our neighbors. Mother Teresa's shoes were too small, not because she was trying to create pain and suffering for herself. Right? Her shoes were too small because she wore the only shoes that were left after she made sure that everyone else had shoes that fit. She was practicing what Paul describes in Philippians as count others as more significant than yourselves, and look not to your own interest, but to the interest of others. She was doing the exact opposite of what many do with charity or with churches in our culture, where we give our hand-me-downs. We give our used stuff. We give our sometimes broken stuff away for those in need. She made sure others had the best, and she took the worst. See, Mother Teresa was able to rejoice that she had enough shoes to share with her neighbors. And she constantly gave thanks to God for providing them. And she thought deeply about who Jesus is and what he is like. And as she looked at any two pairs of shoes in her possession, she didn't see herself as more deserving of the better pair than her neighbor. And so over and over and over and over and over, Mother Teresa made the same decision every day. Two pairs of shoes, two people. And she consistently gave the better fitting pair to the other person. You can see why this isn't as simple as wearing shoes that are too small. She wasn't forcing herself to suffer for suffering's sake. Suffering was the cost. It was the byproduct of an act of love, an act of choosing someone, elevating somebody above herself. And imitating Mother Teresa isn't as simple as going to India and doing what she did in the same communities where she did it. See, many people have actually unintentionally hurt the poor by seeing those who are poor as problems to fix or to save. It's too easy to fly over the poor and drop resources and then fly out, never knowing them, never being with them, knowing names, giving them the dignity of their humanity. But Mother Teresa's work was so very different. See, she saw those who were suffering in extreme poverty. She saw them as human beings created and loved by God. Her work among the poor wasn't to rescue them out of their poverty, but to give those who were dying from it basic human dignity. She wanted those who were forgotten by society to know that they were not forgotten by God and not forgotten by God's people. She was able to rejoice over each and every life, no matter how little worth society gave to them. She brought the gentleness of Jesus to every interaction. She refused to worry, but instead she entrusted each life, even to death, to God in prayer. She was able to give thanks for these people, these named people and their lives. And Mother Teresa was able to think about these human beings, who they were, what they faced, in ways that were truly unique. She saw their beauty and their humanity and their dignity. She saw the image of God within them. And so hopefully you can see, right, that imitating Paul and Timothy and Epaphroditus or Mother Teresa, it's not simply about doing the exact same things that they did, right? You don't have to be arrested to be like Paul, or to die, or nearly die of sickness like Epaphroditus, or wear small shoes to be like Mother Teresa. No, what these four people have in common with every other person who has ever lived as an example of Christ are a core set of practices that we, Discovery, are busy learning together as a church. See, when Paul says that you have heard and seen in me, practice these things, he has just listed six overlapping practices, overlapping but distinct practices that form our lives together according to the pattern of the cross. You should recognize these from the Practice These Things cards that we gave out for the season of Lent. Reconcile, rejoice, be gentle, pray, give thanks, and think. Now, hopefully at this point, you have some of your own experience trying to put these into practice every day. But today, I hope to help you understand a bit of why these practices, and also how they work to form our lives. And so let's just jump in to reconcile. It's so interesting when you think about it, that Paul, first of all, he doesn't use the word reconcile here. We use the word reconcile because he uses it in other places. Like in 2 Corinthians, where he summarizes the church's entire mission with this word, calling our work the ministry of reconciliation. It's simple. To reconcile is to restore people in relationship. Jesus came to reconcile, to restore people in relationship with God, to reconcile people with each other within the family of God, and to reconcile people with all of creation. The biblical story tells us that in Genesis 3, the fall, human rebellion, created divides and divisions between humanity and God, between humans and each other, between humans and the creation that we're made to care for. Jesus has come to undo those divisions, restoring, reconciling. The good news is that because of Jesus' death and resurrection, we can have peace with God, and peace with each other, and peace with creation. If this is true, then core to our lives is the restoration of relationships. This is just one of the things that we offer the world, right? When our neighbors, they look at the church, they ought to see this unique community where rivals, former rivals, are siblings who eat at the same table, where historic enemies lay down their weapons and become partners in their work. This is why Paul calls out Euodia and Syntyche by name in this letter. And he calls out the rest of the church in Philippi. These women are sisters in the Lord, and they have worked by Paul's side in the gospel of peace. They have been proclaiming peace with Paul, and now They are no longer practicing peace with each other. If in Paul's mind, right, if Jesus can bring together Jew and Gentile, if Jesus can bring together rebellious sinners into relationship with a holy God, then certainly two sisters in the Lord can work out their issues. And certainly the church should make this its priority. In fact, this is priority. I'm reminded of Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount where he says, if you come to worship God, but have anything against your brother or sister before you leave your offering before God, go and make things right. And here in Paul's list, before you rejoice in the Lord, before you pray, before you give thanks, go and make things right. Not just as the people who are divided, but the whole family needs to help do this work, because it's hard. And we need practice, daily practice, making things right with each other. It's not easy. It's not comfortable. But we can't delude ourselves into believing that we can have a close relationship with God, that our lives can be prayerful and full of praise if we refuse to be restored in our relationships. It's interesting to think about the faith that we are passing on to our children, the faith practice that we are passing on. You've heard me in the past refer to this this study, this research, the most comprehensive study ever done observing youth and their spiritual beliefs and their spiritual practices. And what these reveal about the church in America is that we have not made reconciling a priority. There are very few young people who talk about reconciling relationships as central to the gospel, central to our life with God and together. In fact, if you ask the average teenager who identifies as a Christian what Jesus wants from them, you know what they'll say? It is to be nice. Like, what does that even mean? One author reflecting on this study describes the American church as a cult of niceness. They don't mean cult in an overly negative way. Just, it's a group of people who are obsessed with being nice to each other, right? Like, we're nice people trying to be nice to each other, trying to be nice to our neighbors so that people want to know Jesus because Jesus is just the nicest. And so we're willing to be nice to people we don't like very much. We'll be nice to people who aren't like us. But there's no effort or little effort to actually make things right with people that we're divided from, to reconcile into one family people who have been divided. I'm reminded of Zacchaeus, who experienced Jesus' grace in such a profound way that he promised to make things right with everyone that he had cheated, and also with the poor. Transformed by Jesus' love, Zacchaeus became an agent of reconciliation. I can tell you from my own family's attempt to put this into practice on a daily basis that we often read the practice these things card in the morning, and we start the day not really sure who we will need to reconcile with, even some days sort of just assuming like, oh, we're good on that one. But by the end of the day, as we're reading through it again, we've often had to make things right with others and with each other quite a few times. And I think we've all become aware that this is just consistent work. And when we're not thinking about it, it's easy to neglect it. And before we know it, within the body of Christ, within God's family, when we neglect this work, all of a sudden, sisters in the Lord become like Euodia and Syntyche, divided and hostile toward each other, tearing apart the very thing that God has brought together. The same goes for all six practices. We don't become people who can rejoice in the Lord by accident or by default. It's a learned behavior developed through practice. Now, I wish I could spend significant time talking about all six practices this morning, but let me just suggest that each of them is specifically designed to work together to help us together follow in the pattern of Jesus. These aren't six practices that any of us can just do on our own. We need each other, right? We can't reconcile with other people by ourselves. We can't be gentle without anybody to be gentle to or with. And here's the thing, we can't just pick and choose. There's no one that's more important or one that we can neglect. We need them all if we are ever going to take up a cross and follow Jesus. Right? When we spend time rejoicing in the Lord, like really rejoicing, praise, it gets into our bones in a profound way. Something happens when we celebrate Jesus and his character and his work on a daily, maybe even hourly basis. This becomes instinct or second nature to express joy about who God is and what God is doing. But we have to practice joy, practice rejoicing every day in the midst of every circumstance. If we don't practice, our circumstances will take over. They will become dominant and not our joy. Right? The book of Hebrews tells us that Jesus was able to see the cross. He was able to see his suffering and humiliation as joy set before him. How does someone arrive there? It's only through a constant practice, a constant habit of rejoicing, of learning, of understanding who God is in the midst of our circumstances and celebrating him. In the last couple weeks, being gentle has kind of been a huge one for our family. It's amazing how quickly we can become harsh or antagonistic toward each other. This is one that we are reminding each other of all the time. But this was Jesus. Even as Jesus confronted sin and injustice, like he refused to be violent or hostile. He spoke the truth, but he did it always with a gentle kindness that invited people into relationship. See, if the goal is reconciliation, if Jesus died to reconcile people, to restore people into relationship, then gentleness is absolutely necessary, because anything other than gentleness pushes away and creates further division. But we live in a harsh world where we speak rudely to people that we've never met because it's online and because we feel like we can. And we don't have to look them in the eye. But we desperately need to learn how to be gentle. The church could offer the world a gentle presence. We will never carry a cross if we are too busy picking up weapons and insults and harsh words to use against others. We need to learn how to pray rather than worry. And that might sound easier said than done, because it is easier said than done. We are addicted to worry. We're really good at it. We worry about everything. Our lives are oriented then to taking control of our worries, to giving in to our worries, submitting to them. Because here's the deal. We will never take up a cross if we are always worried about what will happen if we do, and if worry is our boss. We worship a God who raises the dead. Jesus assures us we will be fine. That God is working all things together for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purposes. In other words, to pray is to entrust our lives and the stuff of our lives to God who is good and who is for us. It's only through practicing this kind of regular trust in God that we can ever be expected to take up a cross, trusting that death is not ever, nor has ever been, more powerful than God. Moving on, we practice giving thanks because we live in a world full of negativity and pessimism and criticism. Giving thanks orients us toward God and toward God's work, shifting our attention away from sin and life's circumstances. We need the practice of giving thanks to keep us closely connected to God's heart, to God's spirit, to God's work in our lives and the world. And then finally, we need to think about all of the best things in the world. This is another place where our family has been having a lot of daily conversations. It's also a place where you can see where the practices overlap. See, multiple times over the last week, our girls have expressed fear about something. They have truly been afraid about some circumstances they were facing. But with this practice in hand, we were able to ask the question, if we think about what is true and lovely and praiseworthy, then what should we do about our fear? Again and again, like, we've been able as a family to acknowledge that fear and that worry are real. Like, we feel those things. They affect our bodies, our minds, our hearts, all of us. These feelings are powerful, but they don't necessarily reveal what is true. And so what is true? Will we set our minds on the things that are true? No bad guys are going to break in while you're babysitting. Just because your parents don't answer you from the other room doesn't mean they died in the last 7 minutes. The steep cliff off the side of the road doesn't mean that you're going to go sliding to your death. We have to believe what is true. We have to train our minds to think about what is true. This will draw us into prayer. This will give us the courage to be gentle. When we think that we need to fight, that if we don't fight, everything is going to fall apart. The truth reminds us that God is in control, that God has already overcome, that the cross is excellent and beautiful and worthy of praise. Right? This will urge us to prioritize reconciliation when we have been wronged, because when we've been wronged, we want to live in lies. That wrong is somehow enough to keep us divided. But then we're reminded of the truth and the beauty and the holiness of what God has done, dying for sinners, giving his life so that we might be drawn together. How could we stay divided? See, these practices, they train us to carry our crosses. If we can't get these practices right, we will never carry crosses. Like Paul, like Timothy, like Epaphroditus, or like Mother Teresa. More than anything, they train us to live in the truth. The truth above all truths. The truth that wins. This whole passage starts with Paul referring to the Philippian church as beloved. Beloved, those who are loved. This is who we are. We are sons and daughters of God, loved by the Father. These are not practices that we pick up, that we do so that we can somehow earn the Father's praise, so that we can earn God's love, that we can somehow establish a relationship with Him. No, you are already loved. Christ already died for you. You are loved, and therefore you are part of a family that lives in these ways. You're part of a family, and this family has a way of life together. A way of life that is constantly reconciling, restoring people in relationship. A family, a household that rejoices because of who God is and what God is doing. You're part of a household that is gentle with each other. Part of a household that chooses to give thanks and to pray and to think about what is true and holy and noble and admirable and pure and praiseworthy. These things, these practices, they don't earn anything for us. They help us enter into who we were made to be. They help us live as loved sons and daughters. Because you are loved, practice these things. Walk in your belovedness and embrace your family as fellow heirs, fellow loved ones. These are the practices that will train us to grow up into maturity together so that we can be family over the long haul. These are the practices that help open our lives to love so that we can grow constantly in our ability to receive love from God and from others. These are the practices that will help us grow in our ability to offer love to others and to God. Where do we start a life with Jesus? Here in these six practices. At least that's what Paul seems to think. And it seems to have worked for everyone who has imitated him over the last 2,000 years. Let us continue, my brothers and sisters, knowing Jesus, to work out, to live out, to practice out our salvation in fear and in trembling. Grace and peace.